Welcome to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm your host, Carol Bruyer, and this evening's show is on Media Renaissance, From Selling War to Serving Life. And we have with us some wonderful guests, including David Matheson. And David has written a book called Be the Media. And what it is an amazing guide to becoming the media, how to produce radio shows, how to get your books published, how to produce videos, all the new tools of communication that ordinary people can create and get themselves involved with to get out their message, their truths to the public. And David has gone through quite a transformation himself. He actually was a vice president for Reuters for 5 years and has quite an illustrious, very impressive background. But he has, for the last few years, devoted himself to getting ordinary people's voices in the public media and overcoming the major corporate gatekeepers. And that's actually where I would like to start. I hope, David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Oh, great. Yes, I can. Magic. Right. So, David, can you just tell me what made somebody who was a vice president of Reuters, how you became interested in being such a strong advocate for people to get their voices out in the media?
Sure, it's easy, really. Thanks for having me on, and I want to wish you and all the veterans out there a Veterans Day in memoriam of the people who've done the hard work to protect our freedoms and get our country to the place where it belongs. I was a vice president at Reuters, as you mentioned, and I had the wonderful task of trying to drag this 150-year-old company onto the Internet. And Reuters, as you may know, or as your listeners may or may not know, 80 to 85% of their revenue comes from real-time news that's delivered through, you know, a very robust 99.999% reliable global distribution system that gets news from journalists throughout the world to banks and traders so that they can make educated, you know, buy-sell decisions. And every time a bank merged, which was happening in the mid-90s, Reuters would lose a trading floor and they would therefore lose a customer. So they were looking for new ways of getting their content to new opportunities, such as the online services and the through the Internet. So I came in 1994 as a vice president, and my goal, I was kind of maybe like a gorilla in their midst. I was really trying to get information out to people with a model that would allow people to view their news and content and stock quotes and index and indices data without having to pay for it. And I was fortunate that we had some brilliant people at Reuters New Media, and we all kind of put our heads together to figure out a model to deliver all this information that used to cost, you know, millions and millions of dollars for real-time transactions, to deliver it out to people so that people, you know, I think now when you go to Yahoo or AOL or MSN, you'll see Reuters News. And, you know, we were the first to really start delivering our news to all of these different sites where the audience was. And therefore, you know, we feel, and I certainly feel, that when you give people the right information at the right time, they're better able to make a better educated decision. So I had put about six different satellite dishes on the roof of a building and brought in all of the Reuters wires and feeds into this central location. We're getting thousands of stories every day and 16 different languages, and I would see all these feeds come in. And then I would go home at night and turn on, you know, CNN International, and you'd only see about five, you know, 2 minutes worth of international news. And I just thought, wow, there's so much information falling through the cracks. How can I help? And that's what I did with Reuters. And then I realized, well, I should really use this model for just about anyone. And then I jumped out, started my own company, raised $30 million in under 2 years, and had big customers such as Reuters and Dow Jones, The Economist, The Financial Times, and basically did the same thing, but not just for big companies. I found that there were small individual publishers and just people who wanted to get their information out just like these really big companies did. And I realized, wow, this is a really, we're in a unique time where anyone can compete with the biggest information companies on planet. And that's when I realized I really wanted to take it a step further and put this power into the hands of the people and into the hands of the community. And that's what I've been doing for the last few years as I've been finishing up publishing Be the Media.
And part of that, I was at the National Conference on Media Reform last January, and they were talking about the internet and how it was being colonized, just like every emerging technology, which allows, there's a great opening sort of space for the public to participate, and then it gets colonized by corporations. And right now there's still a huge battle going on so that the internet doesn't just serve the major players but allows the smaller news producers or to get their message out. And do you want to talk about what's happening there with
That's why the book is kind of a cautionary tale. If for your listeners who want to check out bethemedia.com, there's a table of content up there that basically shows that the final, or I should say the penultimate chapter in the book, I decided to include a chapter on policy, on making media policy public is the title of that chapter. And it was contributed by the executive director over at Media Alliance, you know, a 30-year organization that's dedicated to empowering and journalists and individuals, as well as Free Press, which put on the conference that you just mentioned. Free Press puts on the National Conference on Media Reform every year, and this year it's going to be, I think, in June in Minneapolis in 2008, so for any listeners that are around.
Yeah, I think it's every 2 years, isn't it?
That's correct, every 2 years, although this year they had it in January of 2007, next year it'll be in 2008, so this time looks like there's so much demand for this, you know, people are really, really concerned about what's going on with the media that they're now going to do it. They've done it, 1 year in a row.
Okay.
So, and the reason I say it's a cautionary tale is that we're in a situation now, as you said, and as we've talked about, where pretty much just about anybody can create content and deliver it through the internet and get their message out to a widespread audience. And this is unheard of in modern history. This is unique development. And what we're finding is that the folks that control the on-ramps to the internet, you know, those big telecommunications companies and the big cable companies, they're really trying to monopolize the access and the content and the speed of the throughput. So you could imagine, for example, if Comcast had beneficial relationships with large labels and with large TV companies, they could give the cable companies could give those cable companies the fast route, you know, the high speed access, whereas the Be the Media site or your site or, for example, Craigslist site might be throttled, so that you end up with some sites getting preferential treatment and other sites being kicked to the virtual curb on the dirt path, which would of course frustrate users. And then the users would be encouraged to go to the higher speed sites, the sites that can be accessed more freely. So we're kind of a dangerous situation in that these companies, again, like Comcast and like AT&T, who actually had nothing to do with the creation of the internet. As a matter of fact, AT&T refused to get involved in the initial creation of the internet, and Bolt, Barrack, and Newman, BBN, was a smaller group that actually helped build it. So, you know, they have no right to charge a higher fee to get preferential treatment, and yet that's where this is going. And this whole concept is called net neutrality, and there's a great site called Save the Internet. And if your listeners want to go there, they can get a lot more information, not just about what's happening, but also what you can do to protect net neutrality. And I should go back just a little bit, not get too technical or too policy wonkish, but the internet up until 2005 was considered a common carrier. In other words, it was just like a road. It was just like a telephone. Anybody can get on the telephone. I could pick up the phone and call you, Carol, and the phone company cannot and should not discriminate based on who calls, who receives the call, or the content of that call. And in 2005, that all changed. And there was a 2-year moratorium based on a telecommunications merger, a giant merger that took place, where they basically said, we're going to keep net neutrality in place, but as soon as that moratorium is over, we have the risk of losing this concept of common carrier carriage and net neutrality. So it's really a hot item right now. We really don't want to see, if you could consider it the equivalent in the physical world, labels and television programs and film studios controlled not only content creation, but they also controlled distribution, right? 10 companies control 70% of the screens, the movie screens. So if you're a filmmaker and you can't get distribution through a major studio, well, you've got a problem in the physical world. And also there's limited shelf space in places like Blockbuster. And it's mostly really, really big companies that can get their films into distribution. Same thing in radio. You know, if you don't have a deal with a major record label and or a big giant radio conglomerate like Clear Channel, you're not going to get on the airwaves if you're a new artist. Now, the Internet has changed all that. You know, anyone can get, whether you're a small filmmaker or an independent radio producer like your show, anyone can get on and distribute their program. And what I fear and what the people on SaveTheInternet.com fear is that the same forces that control content creation and distribution in the physical world are trying to take control of the Internet and preferentially give preferential treatment to the folks that they have deals with instead of, you know, allowing for the free flow of democratic information through this common carrier pipe.
Yeah, and with every emergent technology, you have a shift in power relationships, because who controls the information? Who controls the public mind? Those are the ones who can maintain power and establish their legitimacy. So this new media is a tremendous threat right now to the powers that be. And we see these documents, like the Pentagon released something saying that the Internet posed, you know, one of the greatest threats to the government. And they were speculating what they could do to control it, because it was such a threat. And I know I ran for Congress against Anna Eshoo, and she has been championing the idea of a counterterrorism cyber czar and labeling those sites that threaten their interests as basically terrorist sites.
Isn't it the same, you know, Department of Defense basically created the Internet, and now they're afraid that, you know, it's gotten out of control and they want to control it, you know. So, but it's also about the power of storytelling, isn't it? I mean, I think what we're seeing happening is that just as the average person is feeling very empowered by all this, we also see the traditional powers that be are losing control of the story. And just like in the past where, you know, the message machine used to be able to dominate our culture, our politics, our religion, our very spirituality with the stories that they forced down our throats. Now we're starting to see that those stories are being toppled by reality and by truth, by people who are trailing truth to power and saying, you know what, that story doesn't make sense, that story is not true. And I think these powers that be have gotten a little bit lazy and have started to realize, you know, that what an empowering tool this is, that anyone can now tell their story. And in critical times like today, being able to tell a story becomes extremely important, you know, to live an authentic life, to be able to get your message out. And so these are the powers of creating myths as well, and the sort of center of all spiritual paths, and not, you know, again, as I said, they used to be able to control this message by getting their points of view across on, for example, a Bill O'Reilly show where he has millions of viewers, or onto Clear Channel stations where they've now just have dominated the entire daily spectrum on the radio dial in certain AM talk radio, where you hear the same message being repeated over and over and over again. And they're feeling, those folks that want to control that message are certainly feeling very threatened by this. I agree with you. And so we're in an interesting time. There's been sort of this fundamental shift in the way people, the average human being, relate to the values and authorities that sort of shape our lives.
Yeah, and we've seen them lose legitimacy just as people find their own voice. And I'm afraid we're going to have to go away for a break, but we'll be back with David Matheson in just a few minutes.
War is over, if you want it. Peace.
Peace. P-E-A-C-E. P-E-A-C-E.
So this is springtime.
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm your host, Carol Breyer, speaking with David Matheson, author of Be the Media. And David, you sent me an intro to your book, and I was so impressed by it. And it was talking about a media renaissance. And I know originally when I went to the Media Reform Conference, I was pushing for the idea of media revolution, saying, you know, reform is not good enough. We need a revolution. Things are so bad. But I loved the word renaissance and the idea of a rebirth, a regeneration, something hopeful, nonviolent, peaceful. And I think the intro to the book described it really well, and you want to share how that idea came to your mind from...
Sure. What the genesis of that was that, you know, this book is basically a compilation written by experts in every field. So I wasn't out looking for those corporate giants that had been successful or those individual artists that used major label contracts or major publishing deals to get, you know, a mind share of an audience. I was looking for the last 4 years for all those people and individuals who had been successful without, you know, going around the mainstream system. That, to me, was more fascinating. And so in every field, you know, there's a chapter on how to self-publish a book. There's a chapter on how to create an independent film. There's a chapter on how to create and distribute your own music. There's a chapter on how to create a blog, how to podcast, how to use the Internet, and how to do licensing. And within each of those chapters, every one of the contributors, for example, in film, both Robert Greenwald, you know, director of Outfoxed and Uncensored and some wonderful films like Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price, contributed pieces to that chapter. Peter Broderick, another well-known producer of films such as Sir, No, Sir, and he contributed greatly to Bush's Brain, to the film Bush's Brain. But, you know, they all said that there was a revolution going on in their own fields. The name of Peter's chapter, the title was The Revolution in Digital Movie Production and Distribution. And the same was true in radio. They were saying that there's a revolution going on in radio. And every chapter had the same thing. And I started to think, you know, there are too many revolutions going on here for this to be a coincidence. Now, what's the only thing that's larger in human scale in history than a revolution? And, of course, you know, I immediately started thinking about Renaissance. And I had approached a couple of people to write the foreword for the book, very famous people who we all know, but I won't mention them because I don't want to take away from the contribution that Douglas Rushkoff gave. Douglas is a wonderful professor at NYU and documentarian, as well as a musician, a Renaissance person, really. And, you know, his books have been translated into over 30 languages. He won the Marshall McLuhan Award for Best Media Book with his book Coercion. And I noticed he was writing about this concept of Renaissance. And it seemed to actually fit perfectly to what I saw happening in every field of the media. And what he defines the Renaissance is this rebirth of new ideas in an old context. And when I looked at radio, I thought, well, just like Carol, just like your show, there's not just the terrestrial radio anymore. There's podcasting, which could be considered the rebirth of radio in this new context. There's satellite radio, there's HD radio, and there's Internet radio. And the same thing in music. You know, you've got a rebirth going on in music between peer-to-peer file sharing and MP3 digital files, digital downloads. Same thing in film. You've got digital cameras and digital projectors where anyone right now with a $300 or actually even a $79 cell phone can take a video clip, upload it to YouTube, and all of a sudden they've got an audience of millions of people. Now, if that's not a renaissance, I don't know what is. So I started looking a little bit deeper. I scratched the surface, and Douglas was wonderful enough to contribute the foreword to the book where he basically is saying that we are undergoing this renaissance, and it's more important for historians to pinpoint these giant power shifts globally by focusing on Renaissance periods rather than revolutionary periods, because as the word suggests, as Douglas says, revolutions are merely cycles. You know, you just go in a circle where one oppressed group, for example, the Patriots in the United States of America 200 years ago, you know, basically overthrew one King George, and here we are 200 years later facing another King George who would just be very delighted to trample on our Constitution. So the oppressed group seems to overturn the status quo and in sometimes becomes the oppressor itself. So how do we move away from this revolutionary frame? The Renaissances, on the other hand, are not. If we look at the three or four most recent Renaissance periods in human history, they're much broader in spirit. They offer a much broader opportunity for social change. We've seen it in almost every one of them that has occurred. And just briefly, maybe I'll walk through a couple and give a couple of examples. Douglas isn't the only one writing about this. You know, you've got very famous people from Karen Armstrong. Karen Armstrong wrote The History of God. She's now written a wonderful book called The Great Transformation, which really talks about one of the first Renaissance periods, which was the Axial Age, which occurred between 800 and 200 before Christ. And this was a period of six centuries that basically led to almost all of the sages and saints who walked on earth. I mean, it was a period of Lao Tzu, the first Buddha in India. We had the prophets in Jeremiah and others. You had Socrates, Confucius in China, Jeremiah, again, another prophet, and Muhammad. These were all some of the greatest sages that still influence us today that were born in that period and that influenced society in that period. And what did it entail? It basically entailed a complete shift in the way individuals, basically it was a shift in individual consciousness. It basically formed the individual consciousness and this birth of giving birth in some ways to an individual self, sense of self. And when you compare that to today's Renaissance, you know, it's almost like we're moving from that individual sense of self and towards a community, whereas they moved from the tribe orientation to individual orientation. Now it seems like we're maybe going towards a global initiation where we're seeing being born a understanding that it's not just individuals. And that's why my book has two parts. The first part is the personal media renaissance, or what I like to call me media. And the second half of the book is called the community media renaissance, which I like to call we media. And I think that that's the new evolution in just as we moved from the Axial Age. But the Axial Age then, you know, if you look a couple hundred years, and again, if you think of this, axial means pivot, right? And it was a pivotal time because, and just like today, we're in a pivotal time. Back then, iron had just been invented. Better weapons. It was the beginning of the Iron Age. Better weapons had been invented. This was a shock to people at the time. There was a lot of fear. And just like today, we see humanity with these nuclear weapons and suitcase bombs. There's just this tremendous fear. We're again at a pivotal point. And I think if humanity is to survive, we do need better spiritual, mental, and physical tools for survival, and we're going to need to transform ourselves somewhat. The next Renaissance period, and I'll go briefly through these, was Carolingian Renaissance, which was Charlemagne from the 8th to 9th century. And you saw these evolution of common languages and writing styles, which allowed for the communication abilities across most of Europe. And you saw these wide-ranging social movements in that period. Then there was the 12th century, which was the rise of vernacular languages, which again allowed people to communicate across cultures and across countries. And then, of course, the ones that most people refer to as the Renaissance period, the 14th through the 17th century. And again, you saw this flowering of, it was this rebirth of certain classical ideas that had been long lost to Europe, from the Greek and Arabic texts into Latin. And just again, another wonderful time for opportunity.
Well, let's come back to the Renaissance after this break, because I think this is key information. Welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. That is Tom Chelston singing. And David, you were talking about the Renaissance. And do you want to talk, too, about what happened with the power structures during the Renaissance?
Absolutely. And I'd love to also turn the mic back around, because there was a Renaissance moment that occurred just a week ago, you know, on Guy Fawkes Day, where Ron Paul raised $4 million for his presidential campaign, basically through online donations and micro donations. And so I'd like to touch on that. And I know we've gone through a real sweep of history through, you know, from 800 BC to today is kind of and looking at four distinct Renaissance periods. It's a big gasp of air to kind of get it all in. But the big point to remember of the most recent Renaissance, the invention of the printing press, for example, in the 1400s, basically, it paved the way for everything from centralized currency to the Protestant Reformation, all the way to the concept of personal liberty and government by democracy, pretty much what we know, live, and breathe today. And if you look at what's happening today with the invention of computers and networking, it's just sort of a reviving these dormant systems of commerce and credit, collectivism, cultural production. We're giving basically the power to the people, these tools for them to tell stories and also to topple the existing storytellers and to hold them accountable for potential lies and delusional content. So the interesting thing, again, between the previous Renaissance and today is, in the previous Renaissance, everyone kind of wanted to get their, the latest works of art or read the Bible or see the stained glass representations of the Bible. Today, it's not enough for that, right? And today, what Douglas Rushkoff says is, it's not enough for us to have access to all these great works, or to pick whatever channel of programming. We actually want to create the next work of art, right? We actually, it's not enough to just listen to a politician or a minister tell us how things are or how they're supposed to be. Douglas, again, says we want our turn at the pulpit, too, and chat rooms and blogs and wikis, video blogs and podcasts, they're giving us that ability not just to read but to write. It brings us to the position of author, to be able to not just reflect but even affect this grand narrative. And that's why I'd maybe like to bounce it back to you, because there are people I know who are listening from your audience who understand the sort of connection between money and my audience, maybe that might be listening, or people who are not as familiar, might be interested in hearing from you about this perspective of, you know, sort of what happened on November 5th. Ron Paul raised $4 million. This is a real Renaissance moment. You know, a lot of people think Guy Fawkes was a victim, one of the first victims potentially on a large scale of a false flag operation. And to think that Ron Paul did this all on Guy Fawkes Day and raised this money is kind of interesting, I think.
Yeah, and actually that song, too, about impeachment, I think what we see, too, in this past week is Kucinich going out on the floor of Congress and raising the impeachment issue, which is so taboo by the press, and yet the Republicans looked at it as an opportunity to make the Democrats look bad and have an argument, and they opened up a huge can of worms, because this taboo issue that the media likes to dismiss as, oh, absolutely wacko, cuckoo, unconceivable, etc., most ordinary people recognize that the biggest criminals are the ones occupying the White House and Congress at this time, and we're raising issues that resonate very, very strongly with, I would say, ordinary people. So what we're seeing is the old rules aren't applying. What we're doing is, I think, changing the rules of the game. And instead of having just a few players at the top who just were able to completely dominate the world, there's more and more people playing now and participating and able to affect change.
Absolutely. I'd like to give another quote from Doug, from Douglas Rushkoff, from the foreword to my book, Be the Media. He basically says, you know, we're now not just game program. We're not just being programmed anymore. We're actually playing the game. And as he says, as creators of testimony rather than believers in testament, we begin to become aware of just how much of our reality is up for discussion. So much of what seemed like impenetrable hardware is actually software and ripe for reprogramming. The stories we use to understand the world begin to seem less like explanations and more like collaborations. And then he goes on to say that this gives us the courage to give us the, these tools give us the courage to develop narratives together. And there's some wonderful, you know, films and some wonderful, well, wonderful books out there. But again, just calling the calling out these organizations, individuals, and groups that will lie and send people off to unholy and ungodly wars. There's a great movie by Norman Penn, Norman Solomon, narrated by Sean Penn, called War Made Easy, where he basically just lists, you know, this isn't a Republican or a Democrat thing. You know, U.S. militism or corporate militism is bipartisan. It's corporate. You know, he goes over saying that our leaders will do everything they can to avoid war. Our leaders will never tell us lies. You know, this Saddam Hussein is a modern-day Hitler. This is about human rights. It's not about oil. You know, and then when you pick apart all of these PR efforts, you know, you start to see that propaganda is essential to waging war.
Right, right, right. And that the best liars are the ones who are at the top of so many of these organizations, which are losing all their legitimacy and credibility. I know I was stunned. We had the presidents of ABC, NBC, CBS at Stanford University talking about the media coverage of the 2004 elections. And each one of them proudly said how great the election was, how there were very little, hardly anything went wrong with the 2004 elections, and then they were foolish enough to have open mics, and of course a lot of us spoke out and challenged the 2004 elections. That again, it was a taboo topic, but they weren't, the presidents of ABC, NBC, and CBS weren't able to respond very well. In fact, I think the only reason that the powers that be can really get away with the game is by not allowing certain questions to be raised. The only way they stay in power is through secrecy, through the support of the media. And when the media allows questions, allows issues, allows basic facts to come up, then, you know, then there can be a huge, enormous popular outcry. I think that's one reason. I don't know if you're familiar with William Pepper's book, An Active State. It's a very good book looking at the assassination of Martin Luther King. He was the King family's lawyer. And in court, the King family won their case showing that, yes, the government conspired to kill Martin Luther King. But it was never reported in the mainstream media. There was one television reporter who actually lost his job because he wanted to get the story out on the air. And in William Pepper's book, he talked about in detail about the investigations and the case, and a lot of the firsthand witnesses who knew, you know, who were firsthand, you know, direct witnesses to what happened, they lived. But the journalists, the high profile journalists who went to investigate the cases, there was at least one of them that was murdered, and I think the press is sometimes a greater threat to the powers than be than even direct eyewitnesses, because how the information gets out to the people, I think I've noticed it being a grassroots activist. It's like the free speech. Yeah, you can have free speech as long as you can't be seen and you can't be heard. You can say anything you want to do. But if you can be seen and you can be heard by a lot of people, that then the pressure on you is much greater. You're a much greater threat. And I've noticed, especially the taboo topics, the higher up you go, the harder it is for people to speak out.
Yeah.
I'm afraid we have another break, but we'll be back with David Matheson in just a few minutes. Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm your host, Carol Bruyer, speaking with David Matheson. And during the break, I couldn't help but think about last night. I have three teenage boys, and one of them's involved in theater. And we rented Shakespeare in Love, and we're watching it again and looking at the comments of how it was created and how during the Elizabethan era, the theater was considered very subversive and I think a great contributor for the social change in that era. And I can't help feeling that creativity, usually it comes because necessity is the mother of invention. And in order to get ideas out, it's always been art, theater, where you can reach people, even jokes, going around the traditional wisdom of the time. And I think this is what the Renaissance is all about. It's where people find their voice, get their voices out, and it's really out of sheer necessity that people are so creative to getting their voice heard.
This is a hopeful, you know, I know it seems like we're in dire times, but interestingly enough, during the Axial Age, they were in dire times as well. In almost every corner of the globe, again, it was the birth of the Iron Age, and you had tremendous upheavals going on in Asia. You had tremendous upheavals going on in Europe. Lots of violence, and those sages that evolved during that time were well aware of the destructive potential of the individual. So what is really required, I think, to birth this new spirituality, sometimes constriction and violence and aggression is what causes new sages to be born, to try to figure out how do we rebirth the idea, the power of the individual and the power of the community, and also the power of myth and the power of storytelling, to take the control of the story and the myth away from these violent, violent criminals and put it in the hands of the intellectuals, the artists, the people we know and we love, those musicians that we support, those filmmakers, as you just mentioned, the theater creators that we love. And instead of empowering and giving our money to these faceless conglomerates that have basically been ripping off consumers by charging $20 for a CD and making you stand in line and pay $20 for a ticket at a movie, why don't we give that money instead to the individuals that actually created it? And that's what's happening now. And that's the hopeful part of this story, is that it seems that we are in a new axial age or a new Renaissance period with wide-ranging potential for social change to create peace movements and to move away from the violence and the aggressive and the suffering and the terrorism that we're undergoing and towards more sacred goals and value and hopeful times. And again, that's why I point back to Karen Armstrong's book, A New Axial Age and the Great Transformation, to at least allow people to see that there is hope, that this has happened before, and that there are opportunities for us to take the storytelling power and to create the new myths for a new generation and for a new Renaissance, which I believe we all now have the power to do. And that's basically what Be the Media did. I basically brought down all of those tools and all of those stories of people like you, Carol, who are creating your own radio program, running for Congress, creating their own TV shows, creating their own, self-publishing their own books, and trying to make people realize that we are in unique times, and it is and the opportunity for creative genius. Now, you don't need to go to a large conglomerate in order to get your message out. But again, it is a cautionary tale, and that we have to be very careful that those same powers that be, that control creation and distribution of art, like Shakespeare in Love and theater and movies, don't take that same control to the Internet, which is now a global communications medium for the people.
Yes. And last August, I was at a conference. It was the Storyfield Conference, looking at changing the story and the importance of storytelling. And David Corton spoke about the great turning, going from empire to Earth community, and Anadea Judith, her book, Waking the Global Heart, Humanity's Rites of Passage from the Love of Power to the Power of Love. They were some of the speakers, as well as some evolutionary scientists. And I actually did, while we were at this place, which was where actually Buddhism came to the United States, and there was a full eclipse of the moon. And it was a pretty special spiritual space that we were in. We published the Conception Dollar, and your website is on it, the Be the Media, as well as the most hopeful websites that I found. And we published at the same time we published the 10th edition of the Deception Dollar, because I wanted to help see this renaissance, to see this birth, and that conference, in a way, we felt we were trying to be midwives of helping to birth sort of this new paradigm, this empowerment, as these systems of death themselves die and allow the fertilization and the growth of all these new people-to-people communication that aren't strictly controlled. And I see that process happening. I see the systems going down, and I see the new collaborations, the creativity pouring forth. I'm very, very hopeful in that, thinking that we will make the curve. And often, if you look at just simple the cycles of human beings, they go through growth cycles, they go through initiations, and often it is when you are threatened with death, when we are faced with the collapse of the ecosystems, with nuclear war, with the promise of another 9/11. You know, that is a time of crisis, but it's also a time of opportunity, because it gets people awake and engaged and alive and realizing that, you know, what I do will make a difference at this time. Everyone is needed right now.
And that's it.
You can't be just an observer, because we're right. All being affected by this.
And again, it's the first axial, you know, again, pivotal, which is what it means. The first axial age was a movement from tribes to individuals. I think this new axial age is a movement. If humanity is to survive, we definitely need better spiritual and mental and physical tools and stories to survive and to move to more of a community orientation, where we're here on the planet. We need to be able to make the most of the finite resources that we have here in order for all of us to survive. And, you know, Ken Burroughs, who's a professor over at San Francisco State today, really encouraged me to look at the work of Michael Mead again, and where he, I'll just give a couple of quotes from Michael Mead. That's M-E-A-D-E for any listeners. But Michael says some of the same things you were saying. You know, one quote is, "In times of great change, the minds and hearts of the living become the creative ground where life struggles to find the great way again." And he also says, you know, we're in that time. We're basically in these critical moments where individuals and cultures, you know, the basic elements and energies of life are polarized. And as the tension grows between these opposing forces of dark and light, right and wrong, good and evil, it seems that we need to require that we choose one side or the other. But Michael says, fundamentalists and ideologues choose one pole, but the creative individual is born of the tension between those opposites. And that's where we are today, right? There's a lot of tension going on, and you see people picking sides, and a Renaissance mentality doesn't choose sides. It uses that creative tension to start and create new stories, stories that are collaborative, stories that we can work on together to create a better future for all, instead of having just one or two giant corporations or individuals dominate the very social, political, and religious aspects of all of our lives. It's time for the people to take control of the story and stop being a part of someone else's story.
Yes, and I think it is a time for visionaries to paint. I know one reason that I've been able to tackle 9/11 truth, which is a really hard place for a lot of people to go, is having been a pioneer and working on solutions for so long, I sort of know that, okay, if we get this monster out of the way, what can replace it? And to have a hopeful, compelling vision of the future, I think it gives us a great amount of strength at this time to, and this is something that we need the artists, we need the filmmakers to help people. Part of, I think, growing up is going through the fear and facing reality so you can be creative.
Right. I would say, too, just to finish, we need to support those artists and storytellers as consumers, to move from consumers of a product to patrons of artists.
Yes. And thank you so much for all your work, your gift to us, and for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Carol.
November. I'm Ron Paul, and you're listening to We the People Radio Network.